Today is Tuesday, July 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president unleashes a threat of war aimed at Iran.
The president's number one goal is to make sure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon.
There's confusion over the White House's assessment of North Korea's stance on ending its nuclear program. The deadline for the Trump administration to reunite immigrant families is now days away. And a well-known stand-up comedian opens a one-man show on Broadway. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump launched an explosive threat to Iran's leader as his administration ratchets up a pressure campaign on the Islamic Republic that many suspect is aimed at regime change. On Twitter late Sunday, Trump warned Iran of consequences, the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered, should Tehran threaten the U.S. Trump's antagonistic tweet in all capital letters was addressed to President Hassan Rouhani and followed a speech by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in California Sunday, in which he accused Iran's leadership of massive corruption and urged Iranians to rise up in protest. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif hit back with his own tweet that began with all capital letters himself, saying, quote, color us unimpressed. The tweets and the speech landed less than 2 weeks before the administration will begin reimposing sanctions on Iran that had been lifted under the 2015 nuclear deal. Reporters asked White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders what this is all leading to.
The president's been, I think, pretty strong since day one in his language towards Iran. He was responding to comments made from them, and he's going to continue to focus on the safety and security of American people.
VOA's Victor Beatty asks Hussein Banai, professor of international studies at Indiana University, if the war of words could lead to a military showdown.
It's a very dangerous phase in the enmity between this administration and the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I think the danger here is that this could spill over into some sort of miscalculation, actually in the waters of the Persian Gulf, or in terms of Iran's behavior in other parts of the Middle East, or on the American side, some sort of a military overreach or overreaction to something that they might perceive hostile. But it, more importantly, I think it opens a door to third-party spoilers like Israel or Saudi Arabia to really seize this opportunity, as they see it, to really draw the Iranians or the Americans into open military conflict. So I think the rhetorical back and forth has really busted open the possibility of this actually materializing into real concrete conflagration between the two sides.
President Rouhani, in fact, told Iranian diplomats on the weekend that the hostile policies toward Tehran could lead to, quote, the mother of all wars.
Yes, and then he went on to say after that, but if we make peace, it will also be the mother of all peace. So that part wasn't widely quoted in the media. But I think his point is one that, look, this is a country that sees itself very much put in a corner, backed into a corner right now, and it will not really succumb to any kind of pressure, especially rhetorical pressure from the United States, and especially out of this administration, which they feel has unjustly withdrawn from the nuclear accord and has put the Europeans in a tough spot, too. So they have to demonstrate some sort of result.
A conflict, of course, would be costly on both sides, but doesn't the U.S. just have to wait for sanctions to begin to bite?
Yes. In Secretary Pompeo's speech yesterday, in fact, he highlighted this, saying with a great deal of pride that Iran's oil exports were basically freeze up by November 1st. That would really put the pinch on the Iranian economy, which is in terrible shape already because of all this rhetorical back and forth and because of the lack of trust by European companies and Western firms in terms of foreign investments in Iran's economy. So that could really destabilize Iran. And I think the rhetoric is a kind of the prelude to all that.
The Pompeo speech at the Reagan Library Sunday night was part of a Trump administration offensive of speeches and online communications meant to foment unrest. But in fact, is this not uniting Iran?
It is. And I think actually the administration is aware of that as well. I think the intention here is to demonstrate that the United States, if it wishes, it could politically destabilize Iran. But that really, in a way, is the front show for what is really going on, which is to really make sure that Iran's tough economic situation worsens, and that by the United States opening the dialogue with the Iranian opposition groups in the diaspora, the Iranian government would reorient its actions or concede in terms of its nuclear program into some sort of a new deal with the United States.
That's Indiana University's Professor Hussein Banai. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump is considering revoking six ex-Obama officials' security clearance. Chilean prosecutors investigate 36 claims of Catholic Church sex abuse. Afghanistan will create a regional force for areas cleared of the Taliban and ISIS. And two people have been killed, 13 wounded in a shooting in Toronto. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. And on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump declared Monday that he is very happy with the pace of ongoing negotiations with North Korea to end Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program, rebuffing news accounts to the contrary that he is upset. Several news outlets had reported in recent days that behind the scenes at the White House, Trump has voiced his displeasure to aides at the pace of talks in pushing North Korea to abandon its nuclear weapons program. And there have been conflicting reports on North Korea's activities. Think tank 38 North says recent satellite images indicate North Korea is dismantling key facilities at a site used to develop engines for ballistic missiles. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Bruce Klingner, senior research fellow at the Washington-based Heritage Foundation, about all of it.
Regardless of whether the president is happy or not, there's no evidence that North Korea is denuclearizing. In fact, the available open-source satellite imagery, as well as leaks from the intelligence community, is that North Korea continues, if not also expanding, its production facilities for its missiles, its nuclear fissile material, as well as the reentry vehicles for the missiles that can threaten the United States and as well as our allies. There's really no evidence that North Korea is committing to denuclearize. And in fact, the very strong critical statements it made after Secretary of State Pompeo claimed progress during his meeting in Pyongyang shows that the two sides really remain very far apart, even on the definition of what denuclearization is.
Isn't this what had been predicted by many experts before the summit was held?
Very much so. In May, when a senior North Korean official publicly made a statement that basically reiterated longstanding North Korean policy, it was no surprise to Korea watchers, but it came as quite a surprise to the White House, which perceived it as a broken promise that Kim Jong-un was going back against the word he had given that he was willing to talk about denuclearization. But because Pyongyang defines denuclearization as global arms control, and as a member of the nuclear club, they'll go down to zero when the rest of the members, including the United States, go down to zero nuclear weapons. So that really was longstanding North Korean position. The Trump administration, however, had thought that Kim was willing to abandon his nuclear arsenal.
Apparently that is not the case. Why then do you think that both Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump agreed to such a summit meeting?
Well, the summit meeting served purposes for both leaders. For Kim Jong-un, it was a way of gaining legitimacy. It was a way of continuing to diffuse the previous U.S. administration talk about a preventative attack on the North. It enabled the North to sort of further divide the U.S. from its allies and to undermine international support for the sanctions that were hurting the regime's finances. For President Trump, it was a way of claiming success. He saw that Kim would abandon his nuclear arsenal, you know, in an easier way than is going to be the case. The resulting Singapore communique was very terse. It was weaker than previous agreements between North Korea and the outside world, particularly the denuclearization section was weaker than the six-party talks joint statement of 13 years earlier. So, you know, since then, we've seen North Korea drag its feet, even on the seemingly already agreed-upon low-hanging fruit of returning remains of U.S. servicemen killed during the Korean War, as well as reunions of Korean families separated since the end of the war, which South Korea was hoping to achieve.
Where do you think this goes from here?
I think both sides actually have an interest in allowing the diplomacy to drag on. What we've seen the Trump administration doing is already abandoning maximum pressure. The president has said, you know, there are already 300 North Korean entities that he's not sanctioning. That's equal to the number of sanctions that the United States government cumulatively sanctioned in the 8 years of the Obama administration, plus the first year and a half of the Trump administration. Also, we've seen Trump and Pompeo fall off of their earlier insistence on expeditiously implementing denuclearization. Now they're saying there's no rush, there's no time limit. So, you know, in a way, with the lower pressure and abandoned timelines, the Trump administration has adopted the strategic patience policy of the Obama administration.
In addition to tweets, what else do you think the U.S. president or the U.S. government, for that matter, can do to either save face or move forward in the future?
Well, they have to decide sort of which path they want to go down. They can agree to kind of lengthy, arduous, difficult negotiations with the North, trying to, you know, reach a viable diplomatic solution. They can adopt a maximum pressure that actually is maximum. They can stop pulling U.S. punches and enforcing its own laws against North Korean and Chinese entities that are violating U.S. law. Or the other options that is, especially if they feel that the diplomatic track has actually failed, we may hear a return by some, including in the administration, to have a preventive military attack against the North. Or there may be a sort of a realization that it's just too difficult and that they may have more of a Cold War, long-term deterrence, defense, compellence, and containment strategy.
That's Bruce Klingner, Senior Research Fellow at the Washington-based Heritage Foundation. The Trump administration says it's unlikely that it will be able to meet this week's deadline to reunite immigrant parents and children who had been separated at the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a task that's proving difficult. Joining us now to explain why is Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Naveed Daizad. First of all, some families have been reunited, but we do have many still separated. How many?
There are still at least 2,000 children still separated from the parents, ages 5 to 17, and there are still numerous children, infants, under age of 5, toddlers, who are also continue to remain separated from their parents. What happens if the government doesn't meet their deadline depends on the discretion of the judge in the district court case. So far, the judge has really held the government accountable to quickly meet the deadline and reunify these kids. During the hearing on Friday, however, the judge seemed to take a different approach and was giving the government much leeway. This is sad and it's disgraceful that the government was not able to meet either of its deadlines and these families continue to be separated.
What are the problems with the effort to reunite? Have they lost track of people? What is causing the problem with actually getting these people back together?
This is a problem of the government's own making. The government did not keep records. Initially, when it separated these children, it did not safeguard that information, and it had to problem solve after the fact because it had no foresight in the efforts to reunify these children with their parents eventually. Specifically, the problems they're having are first just identifying who the parents of these children are. Remember, these children have already suffered much trauma before arriving to the United States. Then they get yanked away from their parents. They don't speak English. They're in a strange environment and practically impossible for them to be able to identify who their parents are, let alone for the government to then find them. The government has therefore resorted to DNA testing, which is both costly and time-consuming.
Some of the people that may potentially have been asylum seekers, we have heard that many of these people actually were. The government disputing that, or at least saying that if they did, they didn't come in the proper way, so there was no way of knowing. What are the legal rules regarding asylum seekers?
The legal rules are clear. The legal rules in the United States and internationally. When someone has fled their country, fearing for their lives, they are able to apply for and seek asylum in the United States. What this means is, as long as they can show a true fear for returning to their home country, they should be allowed to have a fair hearing and a process to be able to prove their fear and seek safety in the United States. Many of these applicants who have followed the legal rules to apply for asylum have been caught up in this net and facing the same difficulties as the others. In other words, they have applied for asylum law properly, but are being criminally prosecuted and are having their children separated from them. Then we have the other group of immigrants that you refer to who may have crossed the border improperly. Keep in mind that the improper entry into the United States is a low-level misdemeanor crime on par with shoplifting, for example. And the Trump administration is using this as an excuse to deny these people their fundamental rights to apply for asylum and have a fair hearing. And you have to consider that many of these immigrants who are fleeing for safety to the United States don't have the resources to speak with an attorney beforehand, to have the resources to understand what the proper procedures are. They are traveling through the desert just trying to save their lives and the lives of their children. They're thinking, as long as I can make it to the United States and wave down an official at the United States, they'll be able to help me. They get to the border. It might not be very clear for them or practical for them to be able to navigate exactly at the proper point of entry. They may end up at some point in between and flag down an immigration officer asking for asylum. And what the government is doing is tagging those people as criminals and creating huge barriers for them to be able to apply for asylum.
There have been some reports that some naturalized citizens may have their citizenship revoked. Has this ever been done in... How could this happen?
That's a good question. This is indeed a very rare occurrence and has been a rare occurrence for a good reason. When someone is accorded U.S. citizenship, that's a sacred right and privilege and one that someone should be able to rely on. Previously, the government might initiate a process to revoke someone's U.S. citizenship if they find out on a case-by-case basis that there was a big fraud or mistake in the prior immigration application. That's in contrast to what the government is doing now, which is a fishing expedition. They are going through, they're making a coordinated process to go through thousands of immigration files and play a game of gotcha to then put people in proceedings and take away their citizenship. Purportedly, the government is targeting only those people whose criminal background information they are now discovering. But in this kind of process, there is a lot of room for mistakes, and immigrants, or now U.S. citizens, may not have the resources to fight back and prove their case.
That's Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Navid Dayzad. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the ancient, iconic baobab tree with its distinctive swollen trunk grows in many parts of Africa. But the trees rising out of the savanna in southern Africa today are dying at an alarming rate. Scientists are not sure why, but many suspect climate change is to blame. According to a study published in the scientific journal Nature Plants, 9 of the 13 baobabs between 1,000 and 2,500 years old have died over the past dozen years. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to Limpopo province in South Africa, known as the land of the baobabs.
A villager in South Africa's Limpopo province ponders over a dead, collapsed baobab tree. The trees are a lifeline for many who live here.
I'm very confused when those trees died, because we get help from this tree, peeling, and then food we get from these baobab trees. Shelter we get from baobab trees.
This tree is estimated to be 1,200 years old. It is among the scores of baobabs that are dying at an alarming rate in South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. Scientists say rising temperatures and drought caused by climate change may be the reason.
In the southern areas of the baobab distribution, we see very few juvenile trees, but at the same time we're losing the mature trees. So what we're probably looking at here is a shift in their distribution in response to climate forcing.
Baobabs are the largest flowering tree in the world and can grow more than 20 meters high. Their trunks and branches store large amounts of water sucked up during the rainy seasons. People use the tart fruit to make nutritious drinks and a yogurt-like food.
It's like a type of medicine. We get energy from that thing.
Baobabs are part of a larger ecosystem that supports countless animals, large and small.
It's so important to the life of the people and the ecosystem. Perhaps it's time we start to, you know, put those species on the list of restoration priorities, because we can plant species like, it's very easy to grow the seed of, to grow a plant from the seed of baobab for those who know to do it.
Efforts to restore the ancient baobabs are growing more urgent as the magnificent trees that have stood here for millennia slowly disappear. Deborah Block, VOA News.
Award-winning comedian Paul Mercurio officially opened a new off-Broadway show on Monday. With over a decade of television appearances, including his own comedy special, his longtime association with Stephen Colbert, now his new live show, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio, plays at the Jerry Orbach Theater in New York City. The one-man comedy show starring Mercurio, who, with the audience members, picks random people, brings them on stage, and talks with them about who they are, what their lives are like, interests, personal experiences, and what they honestly think without fear of offending. I had a chance to catch up with Paul about his new show and how it all came about.
This all just came about, really, when I was doing open mic nights as a comedian. You go to these dive bars, and they were like dysfunctional cheers, and nobody would pay attention, so I would talk to the audience to get their attention, to kind of freeze them for a minute, and then I would do a joke. And from talking to them, I just kind of continued it, and I do it in my stand-up and in the warm-up now. And these stories that people had, like I had a woman literally last night, I said, "What's your name?" She goes, "Nydia." And I said, "Lydia?" She went, "No, Nydia." And she was clearly annoyed that everybody probably thinks it's Lydia. I go, "Why did your parents name you Nydia?" She goes, "My father named me after his lover." And I'm like, "Oh, you were born out of wedlock?" "No, no. My father was having an affair, got my mother, his wife, pregnant, had me, and named me after the woman he was having an affair."
Oh, my God. You can't make that up.
Right. And that's what everybody did, is what you just did. Like, oh, my God. And, you know, you're not making fun of the person. It's just like this crazy story that is cool and weird at the same time. And sometimes people say to me, "Were these people plans?" Because like it always seems to work out. I'm like, no, because I can't call ahead to like Chicago and go, "Look, I need an African American gentleman, somebody in a business suit." Like I can't. Like I think you just listen, and if something doesn't smell right, you go, "That sounds a little off to me." And you know, you don't be overly politically correct either. You know, to the point where you don't want to acknowledge something that doesn't seem normal, you know. I think that's why we called it Permission to Speak, because the second meaning, obviously the literal meaning of you're allowed to talk, but the other meaning is like you're allowed to kind of say what you want to say in the space, you know, as long as it's not super offensive. Like,
that's your job, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going down that road, don't worry about it.
I mean, it's like a little bit like interactive improv, but maybe real people have more interesting stories than you can even make up.
I'm telling you, there's a woman in Minnesota. I brought her on stage, lesbian, very nice woman. He says, "Your partner here?" "Yeah." "Married?" "Yeah." "Brought the partner up. How'd you guys meet?" They start to giggle. I know there's a story. The partner, her partner,
was married and had three kids. These two lesbians met at a softball game, and then they said things happened, and they ended up getting together, and she divorced her husband, and they got married. Okay, nice story. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
They all lived together in the same house, along with the ex-husband and the three kids.
Wow.
And then everybody, like 400 people in the room went, what? like a totally great story. Like, we weren't making fun of them or anything. But then the other thing that comes out of this is, like, people are kind of getting exposed to people that they don't quite maybe haven't experienced before. So there's kind of a cool, like, little after effect of some of these conversations. But I'm not thinking I'm changing the world. I just think people are interesting and I like talking to them.
No, so, but I get your point. And you can see that, you know, you've got such a diversity of people you're bringing up there from that would never interact normally. And, you know, I don't know, there's something about the humanity of just seeing different sides of life.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think it's also, there's a thing that it's a term I made up for me, it's contrived political correctness. Like, I do think that this is a place where people can just kind of really just say what they think.
Now, if they come to your show, do they have to agree that if they're pulled on stage, they'll cooperate? Have you ever had anybody not come on stage that you tried to?
I think only once in all the time I've done this, like, someone just didn't want to come up from their seat. And only a couple of times did I have I can tell very quickly if someone is just like, it's just, they can't handle it. Like, they're getting nervous or scared. And I just immediately say, you're the most boring person ever, and I get rid of them. No, I just say thanks, and
nice.
I kind of have them sit down, and I can tell pretty quickly. And usually I'll bring up more than one person at a time, not for any particular reason, but if I have a few people up there and one of those people is like that, where they're not really comfortable, I'll just say a quick something and then I'll move on to other people. It's just story after story. So that's what's really cool about it for me, is that you're just getting people to kind of be who they really are. And they're showing themselves in ways that maybe on the outward appearance doesn't look like they would be that way, but sort of inwardly they are.
So you're not really funny. They just help you. Is that what you're... I'm just kidding.
I'm not funny my entire life. Are you kidding me? I have two jokes that I've been doing for the last, I don't know, 12 years. I just do them over and over again for 40 minutes. So I thought, well, let me try something else. But no, this is going to be fun. And we always try to emphasize, because I'm a stand-up, I think people think, well, there'll be stand-up in it. There's not going to be any stand-up in it, but, you know, we're going to have some cool people, I'm sure, coming up.
That was Paul Mercurio. His new show, Permission to Speak, just opened up in New York City. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
DREAMS, an acronym that stands for Determined, Resilient, Empowered, AIDS-Free, Mentored, and Safe, is an ambitious partnership to reduce HIV infections among adolescent girls and young women in sub-Saharan African countries. DREAMS is supported by the U.S. government through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. At a milestone event celebrating the DREAMS program held in Windhoek on July 16th, U.S. Ambassador to Namibia, Lisa Johnson, said, "All too often, girls' dreams are interrupted. Research shows a cycle of HIV infections between older men and younger women. When an HIV-positive older man has a relationship with the young woman, he infects her with HIV. She eventually then has a relationship with a young man of her own age, infecting him too. If he doesn't get tested and started on treatment, he in turn passes the virus on to other young women, continuing this vicious cycle." To break this cycle, Ambassador Johnson noted, girls and young women need support and solutions to reduce the likelihood that they will become infected with HIV in the first place. "This is where the DREAMS program comes in," she said. "DREAMS provides comprehensive solutions that go beyond traditional health services to address risk factors such as school dropout, social isolation, economic disadvantage, and gender-based violence. This approach has been highly successful because it takes what works in real life and applies it to the goal of keeping adolescent girls and young women HIV negative and on track to achieve their goals. Evidence shows that the DREAMS program works. In the first 10 African countries that have implemented DREAMS, most districts achieved a 25 to 40% decline or greater in new HIV diagnoses among adolescent girls and young women. Today, said Ambassador Johnson, we are celebrating the first 1,400 girls enrolled in DREAMS in Namibia and the expansion of the program to a total of 5 districts in 3 regions. Ambassador Johnson thanked the participants, the partners, and the government of the Republic of Namibia for the success of the program. The DREAMS program will strengthen the determination, resilience, and empowerment of Namibian adolescent girls and young women, she said. While it cannot remove all the challenges from their paths, it can give these girls and young women the tools they need to overcome them.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.